Good morning. It is a really rainy day, Sunday, August 14th, 2011, at the Stanton Street Shul. In talking about politics of exclusion in Judaism, and this week we're going to be finishing off our unit on Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox. So the general theme so far has been that Saul Lieberman was at one point a very well-respected, prominent figure in Orthodox circles, took a position at JTS with Mordechai Kaplan, still on the faculty, and eventually worked his way up to higher-level positions, and that caused, or seemingly was the main cause that the Orthodox world had for subsequently rejecting him. Last week we saw the case of the prize where someone didn't want to even accept a prize with him. And this week we're going to be discussing as different perspectives, not only in the modern Orthodox world, but also going back to, I guess, one of the biggest questions with Saul Lieberman is that, you know, he himself was fully observant, even though people didn't like the fact that he, you know, lectured at JTS. But in addition to that, his work, Tosefta Kipshuta, was clearly a fantastic work. And due to his brilliance, he had a lot of really important things and certainly contributions to Jewish studies. So the question is then, what are you supposed to do with such a situation where on one hand you have a person who is unparalleled, well, I don't know, unparalleled might be extreme, but certainly was great in his own right, and what are you supposed to do with this story? The fact is, he was still, just because someone teaches at JTS, does not make him less intelligent, does not make him less knowledgeable, and presumably when he would speak or offer ideas or suggestions or his own halakhic perspectives, they would be informed less by his position at JTS as much as all of the Torah that he knows. That's going to be a significant part of today's class that will wrap up the section on Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox. So Ed, take us away.
There are a number of interesting anecdotes that also illustrate the negative view towards Lieberman in some parts of the Orthodox world. For example, Rabbi Nathan Kamenetsky reports that his father, Rabbi Jacob Kamenetsky, was once speaking to Lieberman at a wedding. And Rabbi Aaron Cutler commented to him that, quote, "It is forbidden to look at the face of an evil one," unquote. However, Kamenetsky ignored him and continued speaking to Lieberman. While there is no doubt that Cutler had strongly negative views of Lieberman, the following must also be noted. In 1954, the Immigration and Naturalization Service requested the names of three institutions that accepted credits from Beit Medrash Gavoha in Lakewood. Cutler turned to Lieberman for help in this matter. As one who always treated the yeshivot with greatest respect despite their lack of reciprocity, Lieberman followed up on Cutler's request, and the seminary agreed to accept the credits, which undoubtedly assisted the yeshiva in recruiting students from outside the United States.
This is a fascinating paragraph. There are actually several of these. Again, all the sources are from Mark Shapiro's wonderful book, Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox. And this passage, I think, is really fantastic because, one, it shows that there, you know, certainly publicly, it was like, you know, one opinion is it's forbidden to look at the face of the evil one, meaning putting Saul Lieberman in that category of evil like we saw in previous weeks. But Lieberman, impressively, I think, never took this personally. He could have just as easily turned around and said, you know, you put me, you know, in some, if not actual, chayim of excommunication. You guys are saying all this stuff about me, and yet you're coming to me for help. And in a way, like, if you can call this a fight, it seems that just from a personal perspective, Saul Lieberman seems to have been the bigger person about this, where he sort of, you know, I can't imagine, I should say, that he liked being reviled from the in the Orthodox world, but in no way did that, you know, did that turn into something personal. And if anything, I think it solidifies that Saul Lieberman's employment at JTS was, you know, if it was ideological that he thought he could do good, was more from a traditionalist perspective, in that he was not anti-Orthodox. He might have been pro, you know, teaching Torah through a different venue, but it, from passages such as these, it doesn't seem that he had the same antagonism towards Orthodox that Orthodox had towards conservative, and perhaps that some people in conservative had towards Orthodox. Right. Others in the Orthodox world, although personally friendly with Lieberman and benefiting from his knowledge, were reluctant to openly acknowledge this in their writings, no doubt fearful of how this would be viewed in their communities. Thus, even though the rabbis state that by citing someone's insights in his name, one quotes, bring deliverance into the world, it's a Hebrew idiom of Hamevi Davar B'Shem Amro Mevi Geula La'Olam. The funny thing about that statement is very few people know who said it. Go ahead and look it up. Lieberman was thought to be an exception to this rule. For example, Rav Shemaya Grunbaum, a Satmar Chassid, published a letter from Lieberman in one of his books, but instead of citing Lieberman by name, the letter writer is identified as, quote, Chacham Echad, one wise sage. However, Lieberman's identity is only slightly veiled, since Grunbaum did not delete the letter's reference to Yerushalmi Kipshuto, which is one of other Lieberman's other writings, which meant you could figure it out, even though if you did not mention him by name. Continue.
Hey, I want to ask you, you said Reb Shemaya
Grunbaum.
Now, I would ordinarily think R period would be Rabbi.
Yeah. Or Rabbi, Rabbi. Reb is a small, it's a thing they get from Yeshiva sometimes, but yes, Rabbi.
Reb means Rabbi?
The R dot means Rabbi, yeah.
And Reb?
Or Reb is usually a, you know, abbreviation form of Rabbi.
Uh-huh.
But yeah.
I'm aware of several other instances of anonymous citation of Lieberman's work.
And he puts anonymous here in scare quotes for those who are following along in the audio, because there are these kind of veiled references where you don't want to give him a full attribution, but you also don't want to, you know, pretend that he doesn't exist either.
In 1955, Rabbi Menachem M. Kasher published volume 16 of his Torah Shlema, and on page 234, he notes that a certain reference was called to his attention by whoever, Rabbi Sutton.
By Rosh Lieberman. Oh. Rav Shaul Lieberman. Sorry, put in the Hebrew there for the text.
When the second edition of Kasher's Harambam V'Hamechelta Rashbi was published in 1980, an entire section from Torah Shlema, volume 16, was reprinted. Lieberman's name was dropped, and Chacham Echad inserted in his place. Obviously, by 1980, Kasher felt that it was no longer religiously correct to mention that Lieberman had assisted him. In Kiddushei Rabbeinu David on Pesachim, portions of a letter from an anonymous Chacham
Muhak Echad
are quoted. And this is none other than Lieberman.
Right. So, you know, after all, even Menachem Mendel Kasher in, you know, 55, he'll actually say, oh, sure, it's Reb Shaul Lieberman. But in 80, it substitutes him out for Chacham Echad. Meaning, on one hand, you call him a Chacham, you call him a, you know, very wise person, but you're no longer, whether or not, he says here, no longer religiously correct to mention that Lieberman had assisted him, which is certainly one way of looking at things, in that you find, well, I'll give another example here. A friend recently visited an institute for study of the Jerusalem Talmud established by Gera Hasidim in Arad, Israel. These Hasidim have pioneered a Daf Yomi cycle for the Jerusalem Talmud. They're publishing a new commentary or Simcha on this Talmud. My friend asked if they use Harushalmi Kipshuta and Tosefta Kipshuta, and they showed him that they have these on their desks, and they even use his other writings. Conforming to the pattern we've come to expect, they also told him that they would never quote an interpretation in Lieberman's name, but write things like, "It is possible to say, because, as they explained to my friend, quote, we want people to use our Yerushalmi." In other words, if they quoted directly from Lieberman, as opposed to just using his interpretations without acknowledgement, their volumes would not be acceptable in the Haredi world. All right, take next paragraph.
There is no doubt that most Orthodox scholars who do not cite Lieberman's insights by name are simply afraid of the reaction they will encounter in right-wing circles. But the calculation of others may be simpler in that they regard Lieberman as religiously deficient. Therefore, although they are willing to learn from him, they will not mention him by name. One might think that people who feel this way would simply choose not to use Lieberman's books, as indeed most Haredim do not. However, one can actually find rabbinic precedent for those who use his works without acknowledgement. Tosafot records an opinion that although Rabbi Meir cited the insights of his teacher Elisha ben
Abuya,
he did not reveal their source, for his teacher had left the religious fold. Thus, no matter how negatively one views Lieberman, this source can be used to justify benefiting from his writings without acknowledgement.
Another precedent for Lieberman's writing, but not citing him by name, and this can be used even by those who respect him, is found in Maimonides' introduction to Shmona Perakim. In explaining why he adopted insights from Gentile philosophers, Maimonides famously states, quote, accept the truth from whoever says it. Yet immediately following this, Maimonides also says that he does not mention these philosophers by name, since doing so, quote, might make the passage of offensive to someone without experience and make him think that has an inner evil that has an evil inner meaning of which he is not aware. Consequently, I saw fit to omit the author's name, since my goal is to be useful to the reader. This gives Orthodox writers carte blanche to omit any specific acknowledgments of the sources they are using, as long as there is a possibility that certain readers will find them objectionable. Continue another one here. This is also one of my favorite passages in the book. Maimonides alerts readers to his modus operandi to prevent one from thinking that he is offering only original insights. Others have not always been so careful. One fascinating example is noted by Yoel Katan, who discovered that the frame Rabbi Elijah Dessler, in one of his Elul Musar lectures given at the Panovich Yeshiva, incorporated, sometimes almost word for word, passages from Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. While some might regard this as an unfortunate act of plagiarism on Dessler's part, Katan finds justification for omitting Carnegie as a source based on the text of Maimonides cited above. Dessler thought it important to expose the students to what Carnegie had written, but knowing that mentioning Carnegie by name would have engendered controversy in the close-minded atmosphere of Panovich, he had no choice but to present the ideas as his own. These were his, quote, skillful means, to use the Buddhist expression. So I'll stop here for this kind of concludes like one segment here. Yeah, any thoughts, Ed?
A lot of politics going on.
Explain.
A lot of writers realize that many of the Orthodox Haredim are very narrow-minded and easily angered by certain names and so forth without really knowing much intellectually. And they have to reach such readers, so they omit the sources in order to kind of get the points made without encountering resistances.
Yeah, and I think it's worth explaining this.
It doesn't say much for the Haredi community. It's saying a bunch of ignorant bigots passionately against a lot of things without any intellectual reasons, but, you know, just...
Well, that's definitely an approach, to take. I would even, let's take it a step back into, just really explicate the whole logic behind it. Saul Lieberman, again, undoubtedly religious himself, Torah scholar. the biggest sin that he did for the Orthodox world was accepting a position at JTS, which is why I use this as an example and why I think that this book by Mark Shapiro is probably one of the most important ones you're going to find on Orthodox Judaism, certainly of the 20th century. Because he really shows here that the main sin, or at least the main objection that people have towards Saul Lieberman was effectively his affiliation, in that it no longer matters, or I shouldn't say no longer matters, it doesn't matter if you are personally observant. It doesn't matter if you personally are knowledgeable. What matters is, do you toe the party line? And it kind of is, in a way, there's a bit of a circular reasoning involved here. In that, on one hand, you say, well, we are religious because we listen to the great sages of the day. On the other hand, you're the ones that pick who the great sages are. In that, if these people are really great sages, and again, this is Yoel Katan's interpretation of Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler, you know, is certainly apologetics in one way. We don't know what his... What Dessler's opinions were, or in terms of citing it or not citing it, what would the repercussions be? But let's go down the line of certain possibilities. Let's say, hypothetically, that you know Lieberman was out and out a Kofer, right? Complete denier heretic. You buy into all of the, negative attributions that we've seen in the past couple of weeks. So, a couple of things that you can do then. You can either say, one, you know, acknowledge that, yes, he did something. Well, he actually couldn't do it at that point. But, never mind that. So you would have to assume that by him taking the role at JTS that he was a co-bearer. Otherwise, you can say, well, he did something that disagrees with, that we disagree with, but everything else he does is legitimate. Once it still gets out that he's such an evil, heretical person, well, what are you supposed to do? If you give his... Torah credit, and you actually say that, yes, this is actually an intelligible and appropriate way, you are giving credence, you're giving affirmation to someone who you otherwise think is a heretic. So that's one thing that, one approach is, you don't want people to assume that everything else he does is correct. That's one approach. Another approach, closer to, I guess, Rambam, is that it's a little bit more... what's a good word for it? You're almost doing an end run around the intransigence of your community. If I'm trying to teach Torah, it's more important for me that people understand certain ideas. If I tell people this is where the idea comes from, they're not going to listen to me. If I pass it off as my own, they will. Now, you're right. That does say something about the Haredi community. Because even if we follow Yoel Katan's approach here, if Eliyahu Dessler quoted Dale Carnegie, right? Well, if he was a Gadol, then by logic, they should say, well, oh, must be it's okay to read Dale Carnegie. But that would cause a bit of cognitive dissonance about everything else the Haredi community might have known about, say, reading secular books. Or how could a Rosh Yeshiva read secular books? Perhaps that Rosh Yeshiva isn't a Gadol. And there becomes a bit of a tautology where if the Gadol says or does something outside of the realm of what they expect a Gadol to do, he loses that status of being a Gadol. Far from actually saying, well, we respect such and such a person, and therefore if he says something that might be a little bit different, well, we may expand our thought. We might start considering things differently. You'd sooner reject everything out of hand.
It minimizes the status of the Gadol in my mind. If he has to avoid being caught by his crowd of bigots and simple-minded types, then he is being controlled by them, and he's trying to maintain the status of a gadol, which is getting to me to appear to be more and more worthless, because he's a guy that's trying to keep in the graces of a worthless bunch of...
Right. So on the flip side, what I have found in my limited experience in the rabbinate is, if people are... indoctrinated, and I don't just mean specifically Haredi or people on the right, this would also go with people on the left, to the point where people don't want to think. You can't make people think. It's impossible. From the perspective of a rabbi, if your end result is you want people to have more expanded knowledge than they otherwise would have, you can just focus on, you can just say, well, I'm just being more pragmatic, more teleological, for lack of a better term. Using the example of Rambam, Rambam thought that it would be very valuable for, let's say, people to know Aristotle. But if you happen to mention Aristotle by name, they may not listen to you at all. So you can either try to fight people and to say, oh no, it's okay to listen to Aristotle, but that can take a really long time, a lot of energy, and you might not succeed. Whereas if you get them thinking about Aristotle, if you don't use the term Aristotle by name, can be a lot more effective. Yeah. To give a flip example, many years ago I did an interdenominational rabbinic fellowship program. And there was a woman who was in Drisha at the time who was debating on whether or not she should continue to use the word feminism. Because when you use the term feminism, people will automatically say, or certainly I shouldn't say people, some people in the Orthodox Jewish world will automatically say, feminism is automatically against the Torah no matter what. Whereas if you take away that word and you just discuss the ideas behind it, you may have a different reaction to someone. Or for myself, when I was in Gross, part of rabbinical school, I was working on a paper for Revel where I was doing a master's degree in Talmud, pretty big one, and someone came up and asked me what I was doing. And I said, well, you know, I've got these different sugyot, you know, I've got different texts scattered around rabbinic literature, and I was able to show that it was on the same topic, but there were pretty significant deviations. There were, if not deviations, variations. Mm-hmm. I said, well, how did one variation come to this? There seemed to be talking about the exact same thing. It's almost citing verbatim, but some very important changes. I said, well, how did this change? And, you know, went on through all the stuff. And the person nodded. It's like, oh, that seemed interesting. Had I said I'm doing, quote, academic Talmud, probably would have been turned off immediately. When I actually explained the methodologies of what academic Talmud was, he wasn't going to drop what he was doing and start doing what I was, but at least I think I got through enough that he was able to see there was some value in what I was doing. Sometimes you have to give up certain terms or idioms for the greater good of expanding someone else's knowledge or in order to communicate certain ideas. If the main goal as a teacher in any form is to communicate these ideas, you have to know your audience and you have to communicate these ideas in the ways that would be most receptive.
Yep.
So I'm not going to say that, you know, I don't know what goes on in different people's heads. I'm just offering there are a lot of different possibilities, right, which, you know, people would then impose their own value judgments about is this good or is this not good. What I do think that for our purposes it comes down to is that this kind of solidifies that the greatest sin that Saul Lieberman did was the institutional affiliation of signing on with JTS. It caused a bit of a tension that kind of gets extrapolated all the way out. But the fact that there was such a tension means that he committed since this whole thing is the politics of exclusion in Judaism, right? You're talking about a denominational affiliation that was relatively new in Jewish history. And depending on when you define conservative Judaism, certainly is, you know, talking about this in the mid-50s here, you know, isn't going to be longer than 60, 70 years, which isn't a huge deal. And, you know, even when we saw that, there was a time where conservative Judaism wasn't nearly as threatening to the Orthodox, and then there was, you know, there were certain points where, you know, people just, really took things to the extreme and started really fracturing stuff. But at least here you can kind of see that, you know, what used to be, you know, things of matters of, you know, do you keep Shabbos, do you keep Kashrus? And whether or not that means, you know, you're within the Jewish sphere, by Saul Lieberman taking this position elsewhere, and for all the political stuff involved of recognition that he might bestow on the whole institution, the whole movement, and as we saw last week, Mordechai Kaplan too, was enough to delegitimize everything else that he did, even though on a purely intellectual level, the people who are in the know completely acknowledged that he was brilliant, completely acknowledged that his contributions to Tosefta and Yerushalmi were valuable, just not enough to give him any credit or validation for it. Mm. To me, it's a very fascinating phenomenon. Continuing, we're going to veer off here in terms of what were some of the modern Orthodox, you know, responses to this question here. Take it from Hillel Goldberg, bottom page 2.
Hillel Goldberg tells the following interesting story. After the 1966 fire in the seminary library, I didn't even know there was such a fire.
Oh, yeah.
He and a friend organized hundreds of yeshiva university students to help save the books. However, there were a number of YU students who were not sure if it was proper to help the seminary in this way. Goldberg and his friend were unable to reach Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik and therefore turned to Dr. Samuel Belkin, the president of YU. Belkin advised them to ask Lieberman whether there was an obligation for the YU students to assist in the rescue effort. Sounds like Belkin's being sarcastic.
There was an issue of sarcasm here.
Well,
continue the passage.
When Lieberman replied in the affirmative, Belkin accepted his ruling. Announcements of Lieberman's decision and Belkin's acceptance of it were then posted around the YU dorms. This led to considerable consternation among the yeshiva administration and to denials that Dr. Belkin had said that which, in fact, he had told us. In the middle of the night, officials at the YU Public Relations Department were aroused from slumber by dorm officials, lest they feared the New York Times be informed that Dr. Belkin had accepted a psak from Professor Lieberman of JTS. Further as the night wore on, it became clear that the status of me, who's me?
Shapiro? Me and my friend. Yeah, hello, Goldberg.
Me and my friend at Yeshiva was in jeopardy, for in the eyes of the administration, we had besmirched YU.
Yeah. Shapiro explains here that the relationship of Soloveitchik and Lieberman was not simply personal and familial. In the mid-1950s, in an effort to create a baseline halachic standard for American Jewry, the two of them met secretly while the leadership of the Rabbinical Council of American Rabbinical Assembly did the same likewise. What resulted was a plan to create a national Beit Din recognized by both groups as having exclusive authority in matters of Jewish family law. The members of the Beit Din would be selected by Soloveitchik and Lieberman, and these Dayanim would choose their successors. It was also agreed that Lieberman and Soloveitchik would revise Lieberman's ketubah, with the Lieberman clause to meet Soloveitchik's approval. It is important to stress, precisely because so much false information has been circulated concerning this proposed Beit Din, that it was in no way designed to be a joint Beit Din. Rather, all the members of the Beit Din were to have been Orthodox, and Soloveitchik and the RCA would not have agreed to anything less. The model was to have been the chief rabbinate of Israel, whose authority on issues of marriage and divorce is recognized even by the non-Orthodox. This information was shared with me by Rabbi David Hollinger, who was president of the RCA during the negotiations, as well as a supporter of the proposed Beit Din, was actively involved in all the details. Hollinger's version of events is confirmed by the late Rabbi Wolf Kelman, who was the Rabbinical Assembly's executive vice president during this time, and was also actively involved in the negotiations. Kelman reported that, quote, three prominent Orthodox rabbinic luminaries were approached and did not reject the possibility of serving on a Beit Din if and when established. He further wrote, quote, in reconsidering what led to the failure of this plan, I have come to the conclusion that the major factor was the unwillingness of Orthodox to disavow their right-wing resistance to any kind of cooperation with the conservatives, and their unwillingness of the conservative leadership to disavow their own liberal colleagues, who might have been unwilling to accept the projected jurisdiction of a Beit Din, which consisted, emphasis in the original, entirely of European-trained Talmudic prodigies. Similarly, Rabbi Aaron Blumenthal, in a June 22, 1955 letter to Lieberman, wrote as follows: members of the RA, the Rabbinic Assembly, are extremely sensitive about the charge made against us by our Orthodox colleagues that none of us is competent to serve as a member of a Beit Din. If we agree to the proposal that no one affiliated with the RA or the faculty of JTS may sit on this Beit Din, there's a sufficient number of extremely influential members of the RA who will oppose on principle such an arrangement to doom the proposal at the convention. On the other hand, the RCA will not accept any regular member of the RA, no matter how qualified he may be, on the Beit Din. Our Orthodox colleagues anticipate calling this debate, baited men of such prestige and stature that the announcement of their names and of their willingness to serve would immediately confer upon this baited the kind of standing and recognition of the American community, which no one will be able to deny. It is inevitable that Orthodox rabbis from all over the country, perhaps all over the world, will direct questions to them in all kinds of matters. They will have no love for conservative Judaism. They will probably share the prejudices against us which characterize the Orthodox movement in this country. They would delight in, quote, putting us in our places. Unless some such veto power is devised, they have some great fears about what they may do. On the other hand, the RCA would not agree to veto power by the RA. Thus, it is clear, this is end of the quote, and back to Shapiro, that the Orthodox side never had any thought of establishing a joint Beit Din consisting of both Orthodox and conservative Dayanim. Incredibly, although Soloveitchik, a very strong opponent of conservative Judaism, which we'll actually read next week, had given every indication of supporting the plan despite all its potential problems, the Halakha Commission of the RCA, of which Soloveitchik was not a voting member, rejected it by a tally of 11-6. Lurking in the background of what helped bring about a negative vote was the fact that leading American Rosh Yeshivot, including Rabbi Moses Feinstein, had just issued a ban against any participation by rabbinic organizations and their lay affiliates with non-Orthodox rabbinic or lay groups. I believe we saw some of those responses couple of months ago. Members of the Halakha Commission realized that the approval of the Beit Din so soon after the proclamation of the ban would have created the appearance that Soloveitchik was publicly snubbing the Rosh Yeshivot. Therefore, they decided, as Rabbi Emanuel Rachman put it, quote, to rescue Dr. Soloveitchik from his understandably embarrassing situation. In addition to this, the Rabbinical Assembly was not prepared to commit itself to discipline members who flouted the Beit Din's authority, and this was regarded as sine qua non by many of those on the Halakha Commission. So really, when you get down to the politics question, it's really on both sides. That it wasn't just the Orthodox who felt the need to have absolute submission of authority from the conservative Jews. From the conservative side, if they were to turn their backs on their own movement, they would effectively say, yeah, what we're kind of doing is ridiculous, and found themselves subservient to the Orthodox. Whereas, if the main goal is really to be Marbitz Torah, to try to get people as observant as possible to Halakha, you would expect that such political things might not be considered. Unfortunately, for both Orthodox and conservative, the titles, or at least the fighting over semantics, denominational superiority, or some other form of ideological approaches to Jewish law, were big enough that, people were not going to work together over things. And it wasn't even a matter. The issue here doesn't even seem to be that you can point to a chapter and verse and cite, well, here's where, you know, this goes against Halakha as we see it. Right? There was a certain a priori bias, certainly from one against the other, where the conservatives at this point probably considered the Orthodox to be provincial and, you know, stuck in their Eastern European ways, somewhat ignoring, and remember the classes that we had here on the birth of conservative Judaism, right? The Orthodox could have seen, well, you know, the conservatives don't really have a halachic system, they don't really know what they're doing, who really gave them a right? But instead of actually having detailed, you know, intelligible arguments, sitting down, you're trying to unpack what are your premises, what are your conclusions, does this really fit or does this not, you wind up being able to, you know, set up the straw men of the organizations of either painting all the Orthodox in one brush, all the conservatives in another, often pointing to one or two extremes on either side to say this is indicative of Orthodox, like saying, well, Mordechai Kaplan is indicative of conservative, or someone else on the, you know, right side of Orthodox, like, ah, that's what the Orthodox thinks of us, and you let your passions get inflamed. And it no longer becomes about what is the best way to teach Torah or to come to some sort of sense of truth, but rather, what is the team that you're playing for? And in some ways, you could argue, you know, if you want to think back to the schisms, you know, from schisms in the rabbinic period, right? Then you actually had legitimate sects, or people rejected, you know, the sages, or went off in their own different directions. And obviously, the sages were just like, you know, we're doing something completely different than they are. And scholars of that field will be able to show us, like, oh, here's how they were different, or, you know, here were these major points of contention. But as we started started off with the book that on the synagogues of conservative and orthodox, you know, back in the 50s and 40s, might have been indistinguishable from one another. That, you know, people were recognizing that there were two different things. There could have been some projection of, you know, what is the trajectory that we're both going to go on? Where's the Orthodox going to wind up? Where's the conservative going to wind up? That involves a little bit of fortune telling, which is always difficult. And people think, well, if you do this, you know, X, Y, and Z is going to be the result. You know, did certain things happen that way? Well, maybe yes. I know we mentioned, you know, last week, you know, we discussed the issue of, you know, were they necessarily right, whether or not conservative wound up, but had they found a way to work together and to ignore the extremes on both sides, on the left and the right, who knows? You might have had a very different Jewish world today, better or worse, having the foggiest idea. You know, so there are definitely a lot of factors here. We can ascribe different motivations to why people did what they did. The important point that I wanted to stress in spending so many weeks on this is that it wasn't even so much, and why I thought, you know, Saul Lieberman was such a great example, was because he's clearly observant, clearly a highly regarded, well-respected Talmid Chacham. Before he took the position at JTS, Shapiro does a wonderful job of documenting how he was considered in some ways a gadol, certainly as a level of a peer as the other gadolim of, or people consider gadolim of his age. And just the mere fact that he took a position at JTS and thought differently was enough to have him ostracized completely from the Orthodox community. In which case, we now have a new metric for exclusion. Where we saw that before, sort of an institutional level from Rav Moshe Feinstein, some of his true votes, it applies even to an individual where you could not have any personal, arguments against me. Meaning, if you're going to talk about an institution, you can say, well, here are the whole reasons why we think conservative Judaism is going to lead to some sort of disastrous conclusion. But this would now even apply to Saul Lieberman. As an individual, you would not be able to make those, you know, same type of arguments against. So this wraps up Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox, and starting next week, we'll get into our final segment here of Politics of Exclusion in Judaism regarding issues of women in the Jewish community. We'll talk a little bit more about that next week. Deal.